And now, the Dave Kimchin Show.
Remembering the attacks of September the 11th, 2001, 20 years later. Well, hi there, everybody. Thanks so much for joining me in this little bit of an audio blog slash podcast slash collection of thoughts as we look back on 20 years of marking the most horrific day, I think, in our lifetime, if we lived through it, September the 11th, 2001. You know, it's a date that has always been there in my mind. What would the 20th anniversary be like? What would we feel? What would we see? How would we come together? Certainly, this country needs some form of coming together. I think we can all agree on that. How we do it, I have no idea. But here we are taping this on September the 10th, but, certainly this applies for this entire weekend of reflection, the 11th going into the 12th of September, and a day where we were united, a day where we did come together. I remember the U.S. flags draped on cars and doorsteps everywhere. You know, we were one country. I can't remember a time in my 38 years where we were more united. So that was a beautiful moment that unfortunately, tragically came out of such a horrific day just before that. So what I wanted to do, it's difficult for me in a way because I don't have any, well, we all have a personal connection to 9/11. I should not say I don't have a personal connection because I do. I thankfully did not know anybody who we lost in the attacks or I did not know anybody, you know, who was injured. I had never been to New York around that time. In fact, my first time going to New York was, I think, 2013 or so. So I had no idea what New York City was like other than videos. And you know, of course, every major television show is filmed in New York, it seems like. So, you know the skyline, you know everything. And I'll never forget that first time that I went to New York. I drove up there and I saw where the Twin Towers would have been at that point, 12 years later. And I was a bit aghast because while the towers were long gone, I could think about what was there and what people saw on that day. I do know Washington very well though, at the time, and I'll go back to just where I was on that day. And as I kind of walk through these reflections, I do know Washington though. And at that time, I had been there many times flying through Reagan, into Reagan, and you could see the Pentagon from your airplane window as you're flying in and preparing for a landing. And I knew Capitol Hill pretty well too, because I had done some government youth leadership work back then, probably the first time I was in government. Actually, I seem to have drifted from government to media and government to media several times in my career. And what I do remember is how prior to 9/11, how accessible the Capitol Hill complex was, you know, relatively. And certainly after 9/11, major security upgrades were made. Now, we also were talking about this in the context of, after 9/11, but before the January 6th incursion. The situation that happened at the Capitol there, the insurrection, that's the word I'm looking for. So obviously I think since then there's probably even more security that's going into place, but so I could talk from that perspective, but I want to go back really to that day, you know, where I was starting out as a college student at Michigan State University. And I just moved into campus a few weeks before. Greatest time of my life. You know, I was an hour away from campus. From home, rather. I was an hour away from home, yet I felt like I was in another world, you know? And right then I knew that math and economics were going to be my worst subjects. So it was a day where I was, I believe, a bit rainy in East Lansing, actually. And I came back from South Kedzie Hall. my microeconomics class, where I knew two things. I had a very cool professor who made economics fun to discuss, but I knew that, yeah, I guess I did okay in the class eventually, but I knew that it just wasn't going to be my strongest suit. So I'm coming back from class, and this was one of those early classes, like the dreaded, I think it was like an 820 or something like that. And for some reason that seemed highly offensive to me, even though high school started so much earlier, you know. I didn't even go to breakfast that day. I just got up and went there, you know, went out to campus. I lived in Case Hall, which was the center of the universe in this new world that was Michigan State University. It was, Spartan Stadium, the fortress, I call it, the woodshed, the players call it, was kitty corner from my dorm. So easy access to going to football games, some incredible games over the years, obviously. And then the Breslin Center, which is where the basketball team, plays, the house that Tom Izzo, if not built, certainly perfected, was on the other side. So that was easily within walking distance. I mean, both were like, I think the stadium was like a 3-minute walk, 4-minute walk, door to door. And the Breslin Center, the Brez, as we called it, might've been, maybe 8 minutes or so. I mean, maybe 5 to 8 minutes, depending on how fast you're walking. And of course I saw probably more concerts there than I saw basketball games. I would always watch the basketball games on TV, but, everything was there. We had Goodrich's shopping center, which was around the corner. So you could buy groceries there. Everything was there. Coffee shops. It was still, many fond memories there. But I was walking, the econ class was on the other side of a campus, very beautiful campus. So I was walking back that morning and I went to, got into South Case Hall, went into the main doors. I was going to go to the cafeteria, get some breakfast, which I probably should have had before class, but getting up late, that sort of thing, So I made a right turn to the entrance of the cafeteria, and there were two monitors over. They're not there anymore. They remodeled that area a bit. So I went back to visit some professors, I think, 6-7 years ago, but you had these two big monitors over there. And when they weren't tuned in to the, there was, I don't know if you remember Breonna Keeler, who's on CNN now, but she was the host of a sort of college network news channel that I think CBS Television had at the time. But when that wasn't on and there wasn't I think that might've been before ESPNU, but there was like a ESPN-like channel. There were various channels that were geared towards college students. There was a sports channel, of course, which made sense for a Division I school. And then there was a channel, it was CNN, really. It was a CNN feed. So when I walked in that morning, I saw a gaping, burning hole inside the first tower. And CNN had a Chyron that said something to the effect of like a fire at the World Trade Center. Pardon me, I think the volume changed a little bit here, a little technical working through that. But what I recall on that day was thinking, okay, this must have been a horrific accident. This must have been a horrific, terrible accident. And I went in and got my breakfast. And at that point, sat down at a television set. There's a big television in there where, we would watch the games sometimes in the dining hall, but everybody was tuned into CNN. And obviously, there was this buzz about what's going on at the Capitol. And no sooner than we started watching, the second plane hit. Now, I can't quite immediately recall whether I saw the second plane hit live or if it was the first playback, because I do remember going back to look at all the news coverage, and it seemed like, I know for a fact, ABC, there's a little bit of an explosion on the side that you saw live, but it wasn't quite clear what it was. So they had to re-rack and play it back, re-rack as they say in TV, or take the video back and play it again. And obviously at that point, you knew, you know, Charlie Gibson said on ABC, you know, you have to move from this being an accident to some sort of concerted effort, or words to that effect. I'll never forget that. And, you know, it was clear what was happening there. We were all aghast. We were all completely shocked, like anybody, just, you know, watching. And now at that point, people started getting a bit scared. There was a lovely classmate named Gina, I remember, who was a bit emotional and scared because she has family in New York who are connected to the World Trade Center, as I recall. And so she was desperately working the phone, trying to get in touch with them. And that's when I started to get a little bit of a chill. I mean, not just, I got a chill down my spine because of what I was seeing and what was happening. But then I started thinking, you know, and here we are. Again, I had never been to New York before. It was this faraway land as far as I knew. And I'm on campus. And I thought, well, you know, this is this horrible thing that you know, is certainly a national news event. But I didn't know anybody who had any connection to it until seeing my classmate who was starting to feel some great stress. And I think, as I recall, she was able to eventually locate people, but which was great to hear. But, you know, then we hear of the fire and everything taking place at the Pentagon. And of course, this is growing even more concerning because we know, all right, well, you know, this is the seat of the most powerful military in the world. Should be the most secure building in the world next to the White House, for obvious reasons. I think they really should have the same level of security, I imagine, although it's a bit different considering the resources in both buildings. And I thought, okay, this is, you know, we've never seen anything like this. And so the double screen on ABC News, where you have the smoke coming from the Capitol, or the Pentagon, and then you have the chaos in New York. My coverage, from what I remember, not my coverage, but what I watched was more ABC. I remember it was actually 9:11 a.m. when Peter Jennings took over from Charlie and Diana, Charlie Gibson and Diane Sawyer, the news desk uptown. And, you know, rest in peace, Peter. Peter was my favorite news anchor, and he was the reason I wanted to get into broadcast news. He was the reason I wanted to become a journalist. And, you know, so watching his coverage as they were trying to figure out everything going on, you know, he was working, he had producers working their sources, getting in touch with folks at the Pentagon, the NYPD, the FBI, all of the intelligence services. Now, at this point for me, you know, I'm still in the mode of college. So we go to our 1020 class. And this was Professor Dorr, brilliant, brilliant man. This is our writing class. So this was James Madison College, which was the liberal arts college within, it was residential college, liberal arts college at Michigan State University. And what happened there, pardon me hitting the cough button there, but what happened there was, you know, here was this very dramatic professor who rewrote his own eulogy on his birthday, as I recall. Very dramatic professor, wonderful person, brilliant instructor. He, no matter how good of a paper you thought you wrote, he would take it and rip it apart. Now, this was a class, this was a public policy writing class, but it was also more so, it was designed to get us to write as critically as we were trained to think, okay? So it was really it was a very rigorous writing course. And, you know, when he told the story of rewriting his eulogy every year, I thought, that's different, you know? But the drama followed us into the classroom that day. And I remember Professor Dorr saying, you know, well, I don't have to tell you what this day means. You know, I don't have to tell you, you know, how severe this is right now. And we all just paused to reflect. We were all shell-shocked. I mean, it was, you know, I don't recall any of us getting political. I recall for a political school or college, but I do recall us getting very, just there was a bit of, we were subdued, many of us, some of us were crying, you know. I was, honestly, I wanted to be in front of the television set. I wanted to follow what was happening. One of the classmates came in at that point. I think they were a little bit late. People were straggling in, and I don't think anyone was going to make a big deal of that, considering the massive implications of the day that were unfolding. And they said that one of the towers had collapsed. And that's when I, you know, the bottom dropped out of me. And I just, you know, that sinking feeling you have, whatever you want to call it, you know, class, as I recall, was dismissed early, because we were using it as a reflection period anyway. We had some things that were due, and that was the Professor Dork cleared all that off the plate anyway. And so I recall we left somewhat early, and I went back down and I watched the coverage. And then, you know, I remember seeing the second tower falling. I like to think I have a pretty good memory on this day. There's certain things that are vivid. Obviously there are, most of it's vivid, you know. I may be off on a couple of things here and there, so, you know, forgive me for that. I wanted to do this as much both from the heart and mind as possible. So, you know, certainly giving you my best recollection of it all, the minor of the other details that, you know, kind of may fill themselves in a little bit later, but, you know, at that point, there was this great deal of stress on campus because, you know, campuses were closing. The University of Michigan closed. There were several, I think Central Michigan University closed. And I recall at the time, we were the only Michigan university still open. And a lot of students got really upset by that. Now, I wasn't sure how you close an entire campus. I mean, certainly you'd shut down classes and events and everything else, but a college is no less a city, you know, and shutting down an entire city, at least in terms of, I mean, they weren't going, I don't think they were going to send all 40,000 students home. So, you know, nobody was expecting anything like that, but there was some frustration because we were not shut down. You know, we were, school stayed open, but every class that people did go to, was used, I think, as a moment of reflection and pause and everything. I do remember there was a candlelight vigil on campus later that evening. I wanted to go to that, but I was glued to the television. I was watching the coverage all day. Now, at this point in 2001, now that summer that just wrapped up, you know, a few weeks before, was the first time that I had set foot in a television station. It was WXYZ in Detroit. And, this was, I was a production assistant writer, you know, so I knew even before college, I knew back in middle school that I wanted to go into broadcast news. And so I remembered just how the newsroom operated, how it was an incredible place to be in a major city newsroom. And I was thinking back at this point on this day, what was going on there. I knew that they had a reporter and several people, I think, going to New York City. Christy McDonald, my former colleague, went to New York City and reported from the scene at some point, if not that day. I'm not quite sure when people went up there. I'm sure there were folks probably leaving as soon as possible. You know, I remember talking to some people in the coming days, and they talked about just how hectic it was, people who worked at WXYZ, how hectic everything was at the time. And so, you know, at this point, I had some experience in journalism, early experience, and some experience in government. The Michigan Municipal League, where I was working part-time, the convention, I didn't go because I helped build sort of the youth presence. My job was to inspire mayors to bring young people to network with city officials, you know, and give youth a voice in government. And so we had our annual convention in Battle Creek. I did not go, and they were totally fine with it because it was so early to the beginning of college for me, you know, so I stayed in touch with what was going on. But I remember talking with folks, and obviously everything, you know, the convention was taking place and really kicking off when the 9/11 attacks happened. And so they told me about everything had changed. And I think some things were canceled, if not everything. And there was a bit of, there were different events to reflect on what was happening there. And obviously these were local elected officials who had to make sure that their communities were safe. Nobody knew. I mean, that was the thing, you know, nobody knew what was happening next. Nobody knew if a college campus, I remember that day, the state capitol was evacuated, and the state capitol was literally 6 miles from campus. That was one of the reasons why I wanted to go to Michigan State. It was the state capitol was there. I got to work at the state, you know, not work for the state government, but do some work in government that meant working with state lawmakers. So everything was happening there in terms of evacuation. The city of Lansing was undergoing various procedures. The city of Detroit, we saw all these reports coming across of lockdowns, evacuations of various buildings. Of course, on campus, we stayed open. But in a way, I'm kind of glad we did, because I mean, certainly the police ramped up security. Law enforcement everywhere was ramping up. And that was part of the chaos and the confusion of it all, you know. And so I was thinking back to all these local elected officials that, you know, were gathered in Battle Creek, and how they must have been on the phone working with their police departments and public safety units to secure schools, to secure all the public spaces they had. Because again, nobody knew, you know, what was next. You know, was there going to be an attack at a university? Was there going to be an attack? And then there were these reports that turned out to be false, but remember reports of explosions that happened, like bombs going off and things of that sort. So you just did not know. And I think that was, I certainly had my eyes wide open around campus and looked out the window, looked outside just to make sure that, you know, I didn't see anything crazy happening. That night, and by the way, Aaron Brown was phenomenal on CNN also. It was really, I was flipping back and forth. It was Peter Jennings, and then it was Aaron Brown on CNN, who was on the rooftop, I think at the CNN studios in New York. And, you could even see at one point when the collapse started to happen and all of the smoke across Manhattan and just the pure shock that he was expressing in everyone. So I also want to give a hat tip to Aaron Brown, who I always liked as a news anchor, in addition to Peter Jennings. And flipped across watching the Today Show that morning too, and then the evening news. That night when, the political debates back then were nothing like what we see today. You know, I was that summer, in June of that summer, I went to testify on Capitol Hill about the importance of investing in after school programs. And this was part of it wasn't the congressional testimony that you see on C-SPAN or, you know, this is what was called a congressional briefing, where members sponsored these sessions. But really, these sessions were for staff. You know, so we had, it was essentially still testifying. You know, we wrote testimony, submitted it, spoke before a House committee and a Senate committee about the importance of funding Title V after school programming, part of the juvenile justice and prevention measures that were going on and going into place. So I got a sense of, I remember being on the subway going from one part of Capitol Hill to another. There was the great Senator Paul Wellstone. I say great, not in a political context, but because he was just a storied name, who later passed away I was actually in college when I realized that he died in a plane crash, which was extremely tragic. But Senator Wellstone, I saw him on the subway car, engaged in a discussion of policy of some kind, you know. And so my point is that, you know, at the time it was what are we going to do about Social Security? And, you know, the Republicans only care about the rich, and the Democrats are trying to, you know, jack up everybody's taxes and spend other people's money, you know, the usual back and forth debates that were going on. But I remembered that night how incredible it was to see on the Capitol steps, all members of Congress, most if not all members of Congress, Republicans and Democrats singing, God Bless America. And it was a very emotional moment. And then seeing the late Senator Carl Levin from Michigan, along with Senator John Warner, I believe of Virginia. They were, and I can't quite recall who was the chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee and who was the ranking member. It alternated. I know Carl Levin was the ranking member at one point, Democrat from Michigan, and was the chairman at another point. So I can't quite recall who was the chair at this point, but I do remember them at the microphone together that night, representing the Senate Armed Services Committee, and Senator Warner said, this is America's darkest hour, but I believe this can be America's finest hour. And those words, I think, struck me almost as much as everything that President Bush said in his address that evening. Of course, the race to get the president to safety, and many wondering why the president wasn't speaking sooner, aside from the brief comments he made at the Florida school once he was notified by Andy Card, the chief of staff, that the attacks happened. We would certainly learn how hectic and crazy it was evacuating the president, keeping the president in the air. The president wanted to go back to Washington, the Secret Service saying essentially no. Vice President Cheney manning things in the Situation Room. It was either the PIOC or the President's Emergency Operations Center or the Situation Room. It might have been a little bit of both. It was a time that was, and all of the bickering went away, all of the political battles went away. And so to see and hear members of Congress singing in unison a tribute to America in our darkest day, our darkest hours, at least in most of our lifetime, was really something, So I think that day, and certainly September 12th, the unity we had, we all wanted that to stay the case as long as possible. And, as time went on, certainly we found that more and more would not be the case. But it was interesting in the days following 9/11. I mean, the investigations, I was again glued to the coverage, and I remember seeing, these walls on street corners filled with pictures of missing people. And there was a reporter, I think on Fox actually, who broke down on camera, talking to people who were desperately trying to find loved ones. And I probably would have done the same thing, would have broken down on camera covering something like that. Because again, I still had no idea exactly what it meant to be a broadcast reporter at that time, but I knew that's what I wanted to do. I saw reporters doing it in Detroit that summer during that sort of internship/part-time job, but that was the first time I saw anything close to that. The security briefings and all of the other threats that were either thwarted or reports that came in of a possible attack on, this location and that location. I mean, talk about being on edge and at the same time in deep grief as the death toll went up to, basically 3,000 souls lost on that day, and the bravery of the heroes. We would come to learn of the selfless sacrifices of the heroes, every one of them on Flight 93. Todd Beamer and his quote, "Let's roll," did reverberate throughout the American ethos. And I think to this very day, I mean, you talk about what courage is. They showed us what courage is. They thwarted an attack on the U.S. Capitol and sacrifice their lives and time with friends and family and their very futures. So, you know, I think about the first responders. And of course, we've lost many to illness related to the 9/11 attacks. We lost many to other forms of stress, I think, in the years since related to it. Someone once said, courage is running up the stairs when the building's falling down. And that's exactly what the NYPD did and the New York Fire Department, America's finest, America's bravest. And I think, certainly, of course, the Port Authority, all of the heroes, all of the first responders who acted on their training. And in the years since, those who have fought overseas, avenging America, protecting us from further attack, further harm, all the way up to the killing of Osama bin Laden, and of course, the seizing of what was called a treasure trove of intelligence during that operation several years later. And, you know, who knows how much information in that, treasure trove, as it was called by investigators, helped prevent future attacks and keep this country safe. The interesting thing personally is, or I should say one interesting observation, is that over the years, I would find that from, you know, the time 9/11 happened when I was a freshman in college all the way up to now, 20 years later, it had factored into my development as a journalist and stories that I would cover. When I went back to Channel 7 that next summer, actually, it might have been during the holiday break because I tried to get as many hours of experience as I could. I was just so fascinated by broadcasting. By that point, actually very early after the 9/11 attacks, WXYZ, the Detroit ABC station, switched up their programming. So the 6 o'clock news used to be an hour long newscast. I always thought it was great because it was the only hour long, you know, while the other channels were off the air by 6:30 or in national news programming, Channel 7 in Detroit had another half hour of news. What they did was they took Jennings at 7 o'clock after all the local news was done. Well, Bill Carey, the news director at the time, changed things up so that they would take Jennings at 6:30, which is, I think, the time that he's on there now. Well, not Peter Jennings, of course, rest in peace, but the World News Tonight broadcast now anchored by David Muir. But what they did instead was go to a 6:30 format so that the 6 p.m. news in Detroit wrapped up at 6:30. You went to the national newscast, and then the 7 o'clock news, or the latter half of that local programming, would become the War on Terror update. And it was brilliant, I thought, because it was the only local news programming in the Detroit area that would give people a routine update on what was happening with the War on Terror and the Michigan impact of it too, deployments from Michigan, that sort of thing, tragedy involving anyone killed in action, those updates were posted as well. And I think that's what followed me, you know, the military part of it in the years since, you know, when I first, my first reporting job at WLNS in Lansing, a part-time job, you know, learning the ropes, we covered troops who went off to fight in the Middle East. Now, at that point, of course, it was not just Afghanistan. We went into Iraq and, you know, regardless of that debate, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan would become two of the leading conflicts of our time. And I remember covering it's, you know, this is 2004 into 2005, the tragedy involving anyone killed in action. You know, I remember the first story of a Marine who lost his life overseas, and I covered his funeral. It was gut-wrenching. And then when I went on to Saginaw, my second reporting job, we covered deployments out there and new deployments, and of course the losses of American heroes from the Saginaw, Flint, Bay City, Midland area. And then moving on to, another station in Saginaw, it was the same thing. And all the way to coming out here in Philadelphia, by that point, it was more security missions that I covered in terms of not the missions, but covering the new deployments of troops to go over and provide security in Afghanistan, and all the way up to now, where with the Taliban taking over the country, interviewing a Marine whose interpreter, Afghan interpreter, has been trapped over there and hunted by the Taliban and everything. So I think, you know, where we are today, 20 years later, you know, I'm someone who thinks a lot about the security of the country, the security of a free world, free nations sharing intelligence together, working together, trying to keep everybody safe. I no doubt think that those who work in the intelligence services, the IC, they call it the intelligence community, the military, and our great first responders, the job has, I don't think, ever gotten easier. Technology, I think, has certainly improved in terms of detecting threats, and relationships have improved in terms of working together and learning from mistakes and that sort of thing. But it cannot necessarily, I don't think the entire job, the range and scope of it has gotten any easier. The risk is certainly still there. And so I just, my hats are off today on this day, 20 years since 9/11, before this day and many, many moons beyond this day. My undying gratitude to our first responders, to our police, our EMS, our firefighters, our folks in every branch of the military, all of the intelligence services, and the people who sacrifice everything and have sacrificed everything to keep America safe. It's a lot to think about, and it's a lot to unpack. And one of the things I'll do, Ari Fleischer, the former press secretary under President Bush, George W. Bush at the time, every year on 9/11, at the minute, he would go through his notes and repost them on Twitter. And, again, this is not a political statement, but it was always really profound to read that. And every year I look at that, and I'll be looking at that again as he recalls his service on that day and what he saw behind the scenes, but also watching the news coverage. And as a journalist now, I still learn from that. I still learn that was the ultimate breaking story, and so I still pick up things from, whether it was Brian Gumbel on CBS or Katie Couric and company over on the Today Show, Tom Brokaw, his evening anchoring, Aaron Brown on CNN, or of course Peter Jennings. There's always something to learn, and I find that, I marvel at that. In all these years, there's still something I pick up in terms of the way something's phrased, or just how they worked around the ultimate breaking story with information coming in. So I've been doing all of that this weekend, and the other thing too that has always been touching is, I went from 20 years ago, not knowing anybody, like I said earlier, not knowing anybody who died in 9/11, not knowing anyone who lost anyone, to meeting the families of the heroes who perished, meeting the families of the victims. In Bucks County, there's an incredibly moving, and I hope to get up there this weekend, an incredibly moving memorial to the victims of 9/11. And I'll get the proper name of it for you here, because I think that's important as I look it up here. The Garden of Reflection, I want to say. Yes, it's the Garden of Reflection in Yardley, Pennsylvania. An incredibly moving space. There's a large pond with two waterfalls that represent the Twin Towers. And, you know, we've spoken with so many fam. I had the honor of meeting so many families over the last few years up there on the anniversaries of 9/11 to tell their stories and see how they're doing now. And, you know, despite the fact that life does go on, you know, there's a certain part of them that they always miss on this day, you know, a loved one that, you know, they'll never see again and haven't seen since. And it's a powerful thing to hear them talk about, especially the children, you know, the children. I interviewed one woman who, she was pregnant at the time. And so, her child didn't, you know, never knew, their father. And it's a powerful thing to think about, you know, the generation that's been born, the young people born since 9/11 who don't remember that time, but well, wouldn't remember that time, and how they learn about if they're part of a family that lost someone, how they learn about the person who perished, how they learn about the heroic acts of someone who walked up those stairs, showing that courage when the building was coming down, or just someone born since that time, learning about that massive chapter in our history. That to me still doesn't feel that long ago. It still doesn't feel 20 years ago. I remember the tears I shed. I remember the shock I felt, all of it. So anyway, I just wanted to thank you for listening to this again, you know, not a formal podcast of any kind. Although I will say that I found myself listening to some a rather moving piece of music by Tony Kaye, the former keyboardist for Yes. We had an opportunity to talk with him on the Rock of Nations podcast, where he talked about this new piece of music that he put together, this new album honoring the victims of 9/11. He knew someone who perished in the attacks, and you know, there's something about the keyboards and the drums and the intensity of the music that makes you feel what gives you maybe some sense of what might have happened, what people might have felt on that day. Obviously no way of knowing for sure, but that's been part of my reflection, and certainly just you know, remembering, taking time to pray, taking time to meditate, and self-care, all of those things. And I hope you do that too. Thank you for listening to this. It's an honor to be able to recall everything, at least that I can, from this day and as we move forward. And you know, I hope that we can find new ways to unite as a country and remember who we were on September 12th, something I never forget. And I think that's at our core who we are. And I pray it doesn't take another tragedy or disaster to remember that point. But until next time, take care of yourselves and each other, and please be safe.